should the city of Jax respond to high COVID rates, high unemployment, and social unrest? Good morning. We are live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, Councilman Matt Carlucci on social justice for Duval, the pandemic, and a whole lot more. Get on the line now. It's 549-2937 to join us. Then later, don't miss it as we speak with the entire, well, almost the entire reporting team of the Florida Times Union on their landmark JEA investigation. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers statewide. We are at nearly 433,000 cases of COVID and nearly 6,000 deaths. In our area, Duval County reported its 20,000th case to date. That's in Duval County alone. And we have 236 deaths in our corner of the state. Well, the pandemic has brought home just how vulnerable much of this community is. Unemployment is way up. Businesses are struggling or closing. Paychecks for even the employed are at risk. Rent is hanging in the balance for thousands as unemployment benefits are soon set to run out unless Congress acts soon. And at the same time, social justice protests have come to Florida as part of a global movement. Extraordinary challenges for local leadership as they try to respond to this extraordinary time. City Councilman Matt Carlucci is on the line. He's the new co-chair of the Council's Special Committee on Social Justice and Community Involvement. Councilman, good to have you back on the show. Good morning.
Well, it's always great to be on the show, Melissa. Thanks
for joining us. It's 549-2937 to join us. Let me begin, before we get into all of these issues, by expressing well wishes to your colleague, Council President Tommy Hazuri. He underwent a lung transplant the other day, and while he is recovering, you and some of your colleagues will be stepping in to move his initiatives forward. Councilman Sam Newby will be assuming a lot of his duties. How will this affect the council's governance for the next several months?
Well, Councilman Newby is very capable of leading the council from the seat of the council presidency, and Brenda Priestley Jackson is plenty capable of handling interim VP, vice president, and still being rules committee chairperson. We have a deep bench on our city council, and I think I don't move anywhere. I just stay where I'm at, which is why I've always said Rules Committee is probably the most important, or is the most important committee on councils, because that person who chairs that committee is third in line. But we're going to miss Tommy. I will tell you, we will miss Tommy. Tommy's found his voice in a very good way, I think. I've known Tommy for a long time, And I can tell you, I miss my friend. But on the funny side, to keep me from, the older I get, the easier it is for me to choke up sometime and fight that back a little bit. But on the funny side of it, the good side is he's recovering very well. He woke up a day before he was supposed to. They were supposed to want him to be sedated there is no anesthesia in the world that can keep Tommy from wanting to talk
right
and smile and be people. He's like a Labrador retriever. He just loves people, and he's just lovable, and he wants to be petted, you know.
Yeah. Right. There's so much goodwill for him, and I can hear the emotion in your voice too. So yes, as we all wish him the best, if I could, there's so much gratitude to get into. I know you'd like to keep talking about him, but there's so many questions on our plate here today for you. Beginning with the council is going to look into any costs, any taxpayer money that might have been racked up as a result of the failed attempt to bring the RNC to Jacksonville. That's basically in our rearview mirror. But quickly, how do you see that shaking out?
I'm sorry, what's shaking out then? Are you talking about?
Looking at the RNC and any costs, city man hours that went into all of that.
I don't see where our auditors will be looking at that, other than maybe some security money when Vice President Pence came to Jacksonville. I think he came to Jacksonville and And of course, that would what that would cost in whatever extra security that the sheriff's office provides for dignitaries like him. But I don't think much at all. And I think we put that in the rearview mirror just in case. One of the reasons that I really wasn't supportive of it, other than I'm just not a real partisan person. But my personal feelings aside, I was concerned we would be winding up with a balance due check or balance due notice after everything, after all the lights were off. If the convention had come to town, I think, you know, we could have wound up having some costs we would have incurred. Number two was, you know, all these people coming into Jacksonville, seems like wherever you have these big rallies, there's a spike in COVID cases that come along with it. And so it didn't come, and I think that really worked out best for everybody. Certainly, if under normal circumstances, you know, it certainly would have brought a lot of business to the hoteliers and the restaurant owners and many of the stores around town. But it just wasn't the right time, and it wasn't the right place. So
right. And it's 549-2937 to join us. You, Councilman Carlucci, are the co-chair, along with Brenda Priestley-Jackson, of a new special committee on social justice and community involvement. We hope to invite her on the program soon, too, to talk about this. Talk a little bit about the importance of this effort and how you and Ms. Priestley-Jackson plan to put a focus on these issues.
Well, I think Council Member Priestley-Jackson and I both bring a long heritage of families that have served Jacksonville. Brenda Priestley-Jackson is a very strong voice for what she thinks is right and justice. Mm-hmm. I think she's going to play a real major role in all of this. I mean, I will too, but I'm trying to point out the strengths of the co-chair, Brenda Priestley-Jackson. Very smart, articulate. And I think that, you know, what is kind of on our menu is law enforcement, economic development. The goal of the committee is kind of further equal access and opportunities for all citizens in Jacksonville to establish programs and policies which will eradicate any prejudices or biases that are out there, and they're out there. I mean, you know, we know that.
Yeah, and so how do you go about that? Because there is a movement to allocate taxpayer money now towards remedying longstanding inequities in this city.
Well, first of all, the only place to really solve the problem is in our own hearts and souls, and in trying to put ourselves in somebody else's shoes at times. And that might sound a little sappy, but I truly believe you have to have a change of heart. I had a conversation with Alton Yates in the 1980s. That was a turning point in my feelings towards social justice, race relations, and so forth. And Matt Glover and I have become very good friends. Warren Jones is like a brother from a different mother, and all of those that played a part in me trying to
right, and hearts but, and minds but, are important, but I wanted to ask you more specifically about the funds.
Yeah. The funding. I think a lot of the funding issues is needs to go into programs like prevention and intervention, white and black kids alike. But we've got to somehow catch these precious children as they grow older and provide them with opportunities before they start making bad decisions and winding up in bad groups. The sheriff can't do it all on his budget. I know a lot of people say defund the police. I'm not into defunding the police. I wouldn't even know where to start.
And what about infrastructure? There are huge sections of this community that don't have adequate drainage, sidewalks, streetlights, basic things that were promised 50 years ago when the city and county consolidated. How do you anticipate the council moving funds in that direction?
Well, I have a bill before the council, and it needs a little more work, but I think I pulled it out of a blueprint for improvement, too. That's a study that then-Councilwoman Lori Boyer put together, and it talked about setting aside a certain percentage money as a marker for the amount of money in the CIP for those neighborhoods that don't have the street or they don't have the curb, the gutters. They don't have sidewalks. They don't have septic tanks. They're behind the rest of the city. And it's not just the old urban core, but it's also other places in our neighborhoods as well. So we don't want to just neglect one against the other. We can't pit one against the other. But the way I look at it is the urban core needs a little more help now. And so I've got a bill before the council that I'm trying to establish what that benchmark percentage would be that every year when we have the CIP, the capital improvement plan, that's all the infrastructure, all the buildings, everything that we have to repair or build.
Okay. So it would get at that. Let me ask you as a follow-up. People are hurting now. We've got a pandemic that spiked unemployment. We have limited revenues in this city. For years, city officials have said we should not look at a millage rate increase for Duval County because people can't afford it. But it is now being looked at as a way to raise more revenue. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, first thing I can tell you, this is my 13th or 14th budget, and I've seen good times, bad times, so on and so forth, and I've never found a person who said, now this is the right time to be raising taxes.
Right.
You know, it's never the right time. But our council auditors, who I rely on heavily, have given us a little nudge that they normally recommend a quarter mil increase, just so when you're going through the budget, you've advertised that quarter mil increase, you have a little extra money to plug any potential holes in the budget. This is a little different year because we're in a pandemic, but the pandemic also affects city revenues. And because of sales tax variations and fluctuations, other fees and so forth. The auditors are concerned about making sure that we can plug the holes that there may be in our budget, and to do that is a quarter mil. So let me tell you what a quarter mil does. I'm sensitive to the fact of raising. I'm not tone deaf to proposing a millage increase at this time in our history, but the fact is a property that's valued at $100,000 would pay $12.50 a year additional.
That's okay. So that gives people a benchmark. And I want to go to some calls
now. Let me give them one other benchmark, if you don't mind.
Okay.
A $500,000 home, $500,000, $112.50 a year. A $1 million commercial piece of property, building, is $250 a year. And the reason I want to get those numbers out is because I get occasionally some emails from people that say, you know, it's going to cost hundreds and hundreds of dollars to people for this, and I just want to try to stick to facts.
Yeah, so sure. I hate to cut you off, but lots of people want to speak to you. It's 549. It's 549-2937 to join us.
Yes.
As we speak with Councilman Matt Carlucci, Ty on the northwest side. Ty, you're on the air. Go ahead, Ty.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Good morning, Councilman Carlucci.
Good morning. How are you?
My question is, why why aren't there any people of color on the Planning Commission? And the impetus for this question relates to the meeting that was held on Thursday of last week. Again, there was an application for an exception regarding the regarding a packaged liquor store in District 7. And, and it's going to be off of Gulf Air Boulevard. So myself and a few other members of the community, we voiced our opinions in regards to not having the application approved. Initially, the planning department, they actually, their suggestion or recommendation to the Planning Commission was that it be denied. However, the Planning Commission, they did not go with the recommendation, and they decided to approve the exception for another packaged liquor store. They talked about the fact that the liquor store is next to 95 and the fact that there are other liquor stores in that area, so what's the big deal of having another liquor store? Well, it happens to be maybe a block from a high school, and there are not necessarily other packaged liquor stores, but there are other convenience stores that sell liquor.
And so, Ty, what I hear you saying is these kinds of decisions get at systemic racism and structural inequality in this community, which this committee is trying to ameliorate. And what I hear you saying is if there had been a person of color on this commission, they might not have approved this because they might have a better understanding of these inequalities.
They have a different point of view. Let me.
And I want to thank you for your question, Ty. So your committee, along with Councilmember Priestley Jackson, you're trying to get at some of these problems. And she just pointed out a perfect example of this. So I want to thank you, Ty, for your call.
So, Ty, if you're still listening, let me admonish you to maybe you're the best person to be on the Planning Commission. Maybe there's somebody you know that might be a good fit for the Planning Commission. All you got to do is got to be old enough to vote and I guess be over 18 and you would bring a valuable voice. That's part of social justice is having.
But how are they chosen? So it's networks and inequities that keep people.
Let me finish here. I'm going to take care of Ty's problem this morning. I'm going to try to do that. So, Ty, what I would recommend that you do is send me a resume, a letter that you or somebody else would like to serve, and you can send that to my email address if you'd like, or you can send it to right now my State Farm office is where I'm working out of for the most part. And if you go, my email is Matt, M-A-T-T, Carlucci, or better yet, just call me at 904-703-0999, and let's see if we can't bring a little diversity to that Planning Commission. I'll work hard on that. There's always a vacancy coming up. Let's get that. Let's get some diversity on there.
Yeah, I mean, this is the type of stuff that you'll be looking at. And as I mentioned, we hope to have your co-chair, Brenda Priestley Jackson, on the show soon. It's 549-2937. Here's a tweet from Lisa. She writes, since the mayor purged the Planning Commission, they haven't met an application that they didn't like. The old Planning Commission denied many liquor store applications. We also had people of color on the Planning Commission before this mayor. What about that, Councilman?
Well, that needs to be on our radar screen. Matter of fact, we need to screen, look at all of our commissions and make sure that we're reaching out and making these commissions look like Jacksonville, whether it be gender, race, ethnicity. We should be doing that. So Ty has given, and you, Melissa, have, I think, added something to our menu that we can take a look at and we can try to correct in the Social Justice Committee. And the Social Justice Committee is going to be strong, and we're going to make some changes. I'm not sure we can change the world overnight, but this really hits me when Ty talked about that in your last person who sent in a tweet or a text. That's not the way it should be.
And
I'm not going to blame anybody on it because that won't help me get accomplished what I want to get accomplished. which is to put an emphasis on diversity of these commissions and so forth.
Right, and certainly diversity in leadership on these committees and boards and agencies can make a difference. How we allocate our taxpayer money can make a difference. There are lots of things that can make a difference. And as we continue to talk about this, it's 549-2937 to join us. I want to get at the pandemic, if I could now, Councilman, and how this community is being affected by that. As we look at positive testing rates, high unemployment, parents debating whether or not to send their kids back to brick-and-mortar schools next month. This is a community, like every community in the country right now, under a lot of stress. And so when you're at large, so you hear from constituents across this county and city, what are the most pressing issues you think you and your colleagues on the city council could be tackling right now to provide a little more relief to all of those struggling constituents out there?
Well, we can keep putting together relief funds. I will tell you, I think this council has, and the mayor's office, but the council, I'm talking about the council now, not the mayor's office, council. We've had council member Joyce Morgan, Leanna Cumber, Ron Salem, and there's others I'm forgetting, and I hate to forget people, but those are three or four council members that helped put together, we have put together almost $18 million in relief funds, and perhaps another $3 million at the council meeting coming up. And I think that's helped a lot of people in our community. A lot of people may be still getting calls. I'm not getting quite as many calls on the need for relief funds, but we're going to do another one, I believe, tonight. And so I think the biggest thing on people's minds that I talk to, because I got young grandchildren, is parents and what to do about sending their child back to school, and they got a job, but they want to make sure their child is safe. And then you got the teachers, you know, they want to be safe. The children are a little more resilient to this COVID, I hear, although it's not 100%, than the teachers who may be, of course, older. And I wish I had all the answers to it, but I wear a mask wherever I go. I social distance wherever I go. And I'm in a bad range of age. I don't need to get it. I don't want my wife or anybody in my family to get it. But we have to find ways to work around these social distancing and stick to it and wearing masks. That would be a great help in and of itself. So there's a little personal responsibility that goes along with it. And I hear people say, I'm not wearing a mask. I'm not wearing, they're almost defiant. And I'm like, gosh, I mean, you know, what about your fellow man or your fellow woman or fellow person? We have to think beyond ourselves and think about, you know, the we of our community, not just the me of my community. So through safety nets that we've tried to put into place, and also the public services grants, which could use some help, they would touch a lot of the people that are hurting right now and need help with mental health issues. There's uninsured out there that we could touch if we would invest a little more in that. Workforce preparation would help. It's a tough time. I'm not sure anybody's got the 100% total answer, but I know my office, we've had to really change the way we do business in our office. And it's hit our business a little bit, but you know, we got to keep each other safe.
Yeah.
You can have the greatest business in the world. You can have the most money in the world, but if you don't have your health, you don't have nothing.
That's right. Let's end on that note with everyone being reminded once again to wear your masks, socially distance, and just be smart right now. And I want to thank Councilman at Large, Matt Carlucci.
I guess I spoke too much. We can't listen to another person or two.
We're coming up against a break, so unfortunately we can't. But I want to thank you for your time, and we'll have your co-chair on soon. Thank you, Councilman.
Well, thank you, Ms. Ross. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much. And still ahead, the reporting team of the Florida Times Union joins us on their landmark JEA investigation. You won't want to miss that. But up next.
It meant equal opportunity. It meant that I could fully participate in any of our community events.
Marking 30 years since the passage of ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act. We'll be right back.
Electro Lounge can now be heard 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on WJCT 89.9 HD4 Electro Lounge Radio or on the WJCT app. Electro Lounge Radio, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Hi, I'm a reporter, and you've probably heard me on this station. When I'm putting together a story, sometimes it can start off feeling like kind of a mess. There are times when there's a lot of information to comb through, and it's also just really been a long day. But I have editors who might ask me to make another phone call or double-check a statistic. A lot goes into making sure our stories are fair and accurate. I'm Sky LeBron, and this is WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, over the weekend, America marked the 30th anniversary of the passage of the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act. It was a sea change in opening up society to provide equity and basic civil rights to millions with disabilities. Jose Morales is the ADA manager at Jacksonville Center for Independent Living. I spoke with him about the enormous impact of the ADA and where we still fall short today. Jose, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
No, thank you, Melissa, for the opportunity and your audience. It's a great opportunity to celebrate the ADA and the great impact it's had on our community and many of the and all individuals that live here.
That's right. The 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act was observed on Sunday, the 26th. This was a huge civil rights victory for millions of Americans. Let's go back to 30 years ago when this passed, what that meant for people with disabilities in this country.
It meant equal opportunity. It meant that when somebody like myself, who is blind or any disability, showed up to a job application or to apply for a job, the application was was in small print. Somebody like me would be able to ask for either a large print version or do a computer version or a verbal version to be able to have that same opportunity to apply for that job. It meant that I could fully participate in any of our community events or the court system or the library system, any of our public services, transportation. That's what it meant. It meant equal access, inclusion. It meant that we were all equal and that we were all going to strive to have an equal opportunity, equality.
Yeah, and it really changed the game with such basic things. I mean, before the ADA passed, people with disabilities couldn't even walk into many buildings. In my childhood, there were no ramps or special entrances for, say, someone in a wheelchair. That's just one example out of so many that we could point to as to how the ADA really changed society, right?
Absolutely. And it affects really all of us, whether it affects us personally or somebody we love or somebody we know. 20% of our population has a disability, and anything that we make more inclusive, through the ADA, but even in the future, it's really a benefit to everybody as a whole, whether it is a product, any inventor in today's time with anything they invent. They try to include the disability community, or they at least have universal design or equal access or easy access in part of their platform because it makes a product more widely used and able to create. More people want to use that product because, again, it's easier to use. It's more accessible. So accessibility doesn't just impact us. It really impacts all of us.
And 30 years after the passage of the ADA, tell us about the big issues and challenges the Center for Independent Living works on today in Jacksonville.
Absolutely. So we have an event where we're going to celebrate all the things we've done, and then we're going to look at the things that are still challenging us. So, like, for example, we already have, the right to find jobs and participate, but then there's still barriers. Like, for example, some people still don't have can't live in an apartment because they don't have access to that building, you know. So we, I was explaining, fighting for that universal design model or that more accessibility model, we argue that it's an economic benefit to the community as a whole, but it obviously makes us, really be compliant with the ADA, which makes us be able to benefit people with any type of, with disabilities. So we're going to look at things that, even that during these times, now finding ways for people to have better communications and how to use services that have changed because of the times we're living in, all those things.
Well, I want to thank you for this perspective, 30 years of progress. He's Jose Morales, the ADA manager at the Center for Independent Living Jacksonville, as we look at the 30th anniversary of passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Thanks, Jose.
Absolutely, Melissa. And if anybody wants to join the 26th, we have an event that you can go to our website, joejacksonville.org, or our Facebook page and join. We're going to have a lot of great people with a lot of stories of how they've been impacted and the great things they still have to overcome.
Well, over the weekend, the Florida Times Union published an incredible piece, a deep dive into the history of the failed attempt to privatize JEA, this area's major utility. A city council investigative committee on JEA, meanwhile, voted this week to issue subpoenas to five people to take sworn testimony from them in their investigation into the attempted sale. The TU's reporting helped spark that local probe, along with a federal grand jury investigation that is ongoing. Right now, we're pleased to welcome the paper's investigative team on JEA as we say hello to Nate Monroe. Hi, Nate.
Hi, Melissa.
David Barreline. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Melissa.
And Mark Woods, all on the air with us. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
Good to have you guys. Reporter Chris Hong, the fourth member of your team, is actually covering a JEA board meeting as we speak, so he could not attend, but that shows you the level of the paper's commitment to the news coming out of the utility. Nate, let's begin with you. There's an investigative committee on JEA that just issued subpoenas to five people, Tim Baker, Michael Munns, Alan Howard, Sam Musa, and Kevin Hyde. They want sworn testimony from them as they investigate the attempted sale. That shows you the value of local independent reporting. Your thoughts on the subpoenas that just went out?
Sure. So the council investigative committee decided that they want to hear from those folks, and the subpoenas were brought up because some of those individuals have previously refused to voluntarily come in for interviews. And so they decided that they may need to subpoena some of them. And look, I mean, those people were either consultants who were working for bidders or people who were helping JEA, consultants to JEA. And I think there's a possibility that they could shed a lot of light on some of the workings within JEA. One thing that I think struck all of us in writing our story is that despite having tens of thousands of documents, and despite all of the under oath interviews that have been conducted to date and our own interviews with people on and off the record, there is still huge gaps in our knowledge about some of the things that happened within JEA over the last 2 years.
You know, the story that I encourage everyone to read in the Times Union is a masterpiece, and this reporting has just been extraordinary from the outset. David Barreline, this, as Nate mentioned, this success that all of you have had in uncovering this story really had a lot to do with examining thousands of documents, and you played a big part in that. Can you tell us a little bit more about how the reporting progressed from the beginning and how you were able to get this information out to the public?
Well, I think that as far as the records, a lot of it was public records requests that Nate, Chris, and I had filed with the JEA. I have to give a tip of the hat to Mary Kelly Palka, our editor, who is a real believer in seeking voluminous public records. So we made a lot of requests, and even though sometimes they were slow to come out, we were able to fill in some of the details that way. Also, there were some records that we were receiving from people who were just kind of concerned about what JEA was doing. So that helped as well to sort of create some of the reporting to fill in the blanks. As Nate says, there are still blanks. There really were a lot of blanks a year ago, and we've been able to fill in a lot of what happened in terms of putting together the chronology of events. And, you know, it was not always easy. You know, this was effort by JEA was, although they did have some public board meetings, much of the work was done unbeknownst to the general public prior to the July 23rd, 2019 vote, which was the first time the board really even talked about or said the word privatization. Code names, Project Freebird, there were different attempts to meet off-site. So it was a real effort to try and get those documents and be able to tell people what was really going on behind the scenes, because that was a lot of the story that helped to explain this tremendously interesting, fascinating story about how there was this attempt to sell JEA and what led up to it and eventually the downfall of that attempt.
Sure. You know, Mark Woods, the two most controversial aspects of this, I think, were the PUP, the performance plan, where the top executives of the utility stood to really personally enrich themselves by a lot if the privatization scheme went through. That fell apart under scrutiny, and those officials all lost their jobs. They're no longer working at the utility. The other big question hanging out there that you're still investigating and that the federal authorities are investigating is whether the mayor or people close to the mayor were personally involved in orchestrating the privatization push and whether any crimes were committed. That is yet to be determined, but I think that's the question many that are reading your reporting still have. Let's lay out what we know about City Hall's involvement in JEA's failed privatization attempt. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, and I'd start by saying I give credit to the others. I feel kind of like the fourth beetle, or maybe the fifth beetle on this, that they did the hard work of going through documents and working sources and sitting through meetings, and I'd jump in, and because they kept giving me easy columns again and again and again. But yes, that is the PUP is a huge question mark. It feels like it just kind of appeared out of thin air. And then, yes, City Hall's involvement. And I think, yeah, a lot of people read the story and were hoping that there would be that definitive smoking gun. And, you know, I think it's meticulously reported that we didn't go anywhere that we weren't confident in. And there's certain things we just don't know. So you don't know the level of involvement, but you can certainly see that the mayor, we started back in 2015 when the mayor cleared the JEA board. I think that kind of is when this all begins. And Paul McElroy resigns, and it kind of snowballs from there. And there was this, young Florida Times Union reporter named Nate Monroe covering JEA at the time. So it's interesting to go back and read some of those stories when he was covering the news at that point. The mayor is certainly a element throughout of conversations, of interactions, and then the end when everything is falling apart, he's trying to speed, and Zahn's gone, he's trying to speed up the process, which is very interesting. He's almost kind of from afar de facto JEA CEO, it feels like at times. But there's a lot we don't know.
Right. Nate Monroe, still much we don't know, but the newspaper really is a local, vibrant community newspaper is the only place where this kind of public service reporting can really be done at the level that is needed to flesh out a complex story. And so I really do encourage everyone to subscribe to the Times Union and read this story. Where does this investigation go from here, do you think?
Well, first, thank you for saying that. You know, we're just going to have to see. I mean, there are actually at least three separate investigations happening right now. There is a city council investigation. There is an inspector general review of a couple of different issues within JEA. And there is an active federal investigation, which I think is the thing people are probably most interested in. It also, unfortunately, happens to be the thing that is the hardest to figure out. You know, we're just going to have to see. I mean, there are, you know, certainly indications from the federal subpoena that prosecutors are very interested in the performance unit plan, the PUP, the controversial bonus scheme that we've been talking about for months. They are interested in communications that might have taken place between JEA and the mayor's office. You know, the mayor is actually named in the subpoena. And so, you know, it feels like there are some hints of where they may be going. They're also interested in NextEra, the parent company of Florida Power and Light, which is one of the bidders. They are more interested in NextEra than they are the other bidders. They went out of their way to request information related to NextEra. So, you know, they could be looking at any number of things, and all of them, I think, our reporting points to indications that there is at least uncertainty and maybe hints of shenanigans around any of those topics, but we don't know anything for sure.
David Bauerlein, the old saying is that a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich. We don't know, though, if any indictments could be forthcoming from the federal probe. And if they don't indict, we'll never learn about the proceedings because those are secret.
Right. That's the thing about the federal grand jury process. It is secret. And so if they choose not to bring any indictments, then that information is not subject, say, to a public records request the way that other information would be. So that's the drawback to the grand jury process in that respect. I don't know if there's ways that information might be shared even so with the public through other formats, but we are probably a long way from knowing whether or not there's going to be any indictments in any of the instances that they're looking at.
Right. But I want to thank you all for hopping on the Google Hangouts line with us as we're pleased to spotlight your work. I really do encourage everyone to read the deep dive into the JEA investigation in this week's paper. And I want to thank you all, Nate Monroe, David Bauerlein, and Mark Woods, all with us. The foursome also consists of reporter Chris Hong. He has to cover a JEA board meeting this morning, so he was not able to join us. Guys, great work, and thank you for your service to this city.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks, everyone. Up next, the results of your reader's choice into your favorite local eateries, all in the pages of Edible. We'll be right back.
I'm Brendan Rivers, host of WJCT's Adapt podcast, where we hear from people in our area helping us adapt to climate change and sea level rise. But first, people have to want to adapt. That's where Lauren Watkins comes in, a professional climate change communicator who gets why that can be tricky, even when she's talking to her own mom.
It can be done, and it can happen where you can get to neutral ground and think about solutions.
Subscribe to Adapt wherever you get your podcasts or listen at adaptflorida.org.
On the next Fresh Air, former poet laureate Natasha Trethewey. Her black mother and white father had to leave their home in Mississippi to get married because interracial marriage was still illegal there. After their divorce, her mother married a man who turned out to be abusive and years later shot and killed her. Trethewey's new memoir is about her mother and about race. Join us.
Tomorrow at noon here on WJCT News 89.9.
Every day we've got a whole lot of decisions to make, and to make some of them,
we really lean on the behavior of others around us, because if you think about every single decision as one you have to rationally think through the costs and benefits, you would never get anything done in a day.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The logic of behavioral economics as applied to mask wearing. That is next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6 on WJCT News 89.9.
Education Secretary Betsy DeVos is seeking a rule change to redirect COVID aid away from public schools by giving more money to private ones. That move is now being challenged in court by the country's largest civil rights group. What's at stake is so much more than just hundreds of millions of dollars. I'm Jen White. The latest on this legal fight, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, Edible Northeast Florida recently asked its readers to vote for their favorite restaurants and watering holes by neighborhood. You can check out the results in their new print edition. It's the Reader's Choice Survey. Editor Lauren Titus is on the line. Hey, Lauren, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
It's good to see a new print edition of Edible on newsstands all over town. You had gone to digital format for a while, but now back in print. That's exciting. Let's begin by asking you about that.
Yeah, we are thrilled to be back in print. You know, I know things are far from being normal, but having the magazine to hold in our hands feels like we're sort of on the path to getting some normality back in our lives. We did pivot, like pretty much everyone else these days, to do a focus on digital. We did our digital cookbook. We created a map of takeout and to-go places around town. But now we're back in print, and it's really the voice of the readers that we're showcasing right now and their favorite restaurants, bars, breweries, watering holes around Northeast Florida, from Fernandina to Flagler Beach.
Right. In this Reader's Choice survey, you did break it down by neighborhood. All of your readers picked their favorites. You highlight the top five vote getters in each neighborhood of this community. And people are just going to have to pick up the magazine to read the whole thing. But were there any surprise winners?
Well, there were some definitely that we were not surprised by. Taverna, Prati Italia, Town Hall, the longstanding favorites around the area. It was fun to break the area into 26 different neighborhoods. Some of them were logical, of course, Amelia and Fernandina, Flagler Beach. But some of them we kind of were a little subjective so that we could group things to kind of contain the number of neighborhoods. We ended up with over 750 different restaurants and eateries and breweries around the area, which really showcases the diversity and the great availability of different types of cuisine in our area.
The other thing I love about this is you're spotlighting local restaurants and bars, which let's acknowledge what a difficult time this has been for this small business sector. You're giving them some love, which they need right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So we created this theme. We always plan our editorial lineup a year in advance, and so we created this last year, not knowing how much time we would actually be spending in our neighborhoods or how much love and appreciation of our neighborhood places they would need at this point in time. And we feel really good about being able to help highlight the many small businesses in our area that, like you say, really need our support. If you're not comfortable with dining in at restaurants right now, almost every restaurant is offering takeout. So that's definitely a way that you can continue to show your support for your favorite neighborhood eatery.
Absolutely. Make sure to order from your local community restaurants as much as you can. We've got to keep them going. They're such an important part of our neighborhoods, our culture. Now, Edible is also getting creative with distribution. You've added the magazine to restaurants as a go-to menu item as well, right?
Yes, we're working on that. We'll be able to share some of the details later this week. But we're asking some of our business partners to add us to their to-go menu. And, you know, since we're a free publication, there's no need to collect any money. Though if people want to contribute $5 as a tip to waitstaff, we certainly support that. But we're going to be working with a multitude of restaurants around the area. Since traffic may be slower to eat in or even to go into a restaurant to get to go, we're going to be working with different businesses to have a copy of Edible in their takeout bags.
That is so excellent. Now, people also need to look for the Edible Reader's Choice decal at their local favorite spots, sort of a little seal of approval, right, that you'll be slapping on local businesses.
Yeah, we're getting out there. We have, with 26 neighborhoods, we have 130 winners with the five top in each neighborhood. So we're getting out there, and again, it's our way of helping to support local businesses by showing who readers really love in our area.
And just pick up a copy of Edible. As Lauren said, it is back on newsstands this month, and dive into their new Reader's Choice survey, giving you an idea of which restaurants in your neighborhood you can support right now. If you don't want to dine in, takeout is so appreciated and needed to keep these businesses afloat as we all try to get through this pandemic in one piece. Again, Edible Northeast Florida on newsstands all over town right now. Editor Lauren Titus, always so good to hear your voice. Thank you so much, and I look forward to the next issue.
Great. Thank you very much, Melissa.
Well, that's our show, and thanks for listening. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Jessica Palumbo is WJCT's news director, and our digital editor is Bill Bortsfield. Keep that feedback coming. Emails always go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Our podcast will be up later today, and you can catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow and connect with you then. Stay safe. Wear your mask.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.